Do you wanna dance? We can dance under the moonlight, hug and squeeze all through the night. Oh, good afternoon, everybody. That's got to be the sappiest version of Do You Want to Dance I've ever heard in my entire life. My name is Zeke. I'm here with Bettina. We are the co-hosts of Movement Museum, where we talk about dance in Montreal on your radio, on your computer, on your mobile device. CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on your cable dial, movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer, and Google Movement Museum if you want to find it on some other thing. We have a special in-studio guest here today. We have Roger Sinha from Sinha Dance. He just performed last night at Théâtre de la Verdure, and we also have Damien hanging out on my left, and we have Marika hanging out on my right, and we might get them on microphone later. And before I forget, let me calm down slightly. And
you have to say who they are too, Damien, Marika.
You want
as the mystery guests?
Do you want to introduce yourselves? No.
It's just Roger brought his kids in. It's summer, and they're floating about the studio, very cute.
But yes. One thing so I can calm down and get everything back organized. The Bear on the Delhi Road by Earl Burney. Unreal, tall as a myth. By the road, the Himalayan bear is beating the brilliant air with his crooked arms. About him, two men, bear, spindly as locusts, leap. One pulls on a ring. In the great soft nose, his mate flicks, flicks with a stick up at the rolling eyes. They have not led him here down from the fabulous hills to this bald alien plain and the clamorous world to kill, but simply to teach him to dance. They are peaceful both, these spare men of Kashmir, and the bear alive is their living too. If, Far on the Delhi way, around him, galvanic they dance. It is merely to wear, wear from his shaggy body the tranced wish forever to stay only an ambling bear four-footed in berries. It is no more joyous for them in this hot dust to prance, out of reach of the praying claws sharpened to paw for ants in the shadow of deodars. It is not easy to free myth from reality or rear this fellow up to lurch, lurch with them in the tranced dancing of men. Mm. Yeah, I think Earl Burney is Canadian as well.
Sounds Canadian.
Cool.
Yes.
Now we have, yeah, in the background, William Parker and Hammond Drake. We'll keep them in the background, but now we can get down to business. Roger, thank you very, very much for coming in.
You're welcome. It's glad to be here.
And thank you very much for performing last night as well.
It was a treat. It's always a pleasure to perform at Théâtre de l'Ouverture, outside, under the stars, wind blowing in your face, worried about the rain, but the rain didn't come, so we were there on stage.
Yes.
And just giving our best, giving our all.
Now, there it's... Yeah, I always get a big kick every year out of going to Théâtre de la Verdure. How often have you performed there? Do you have a regular gig and stuff like that?
There's no regular gig, really. It's my third time performing there. Mm-hmm. And I think we're almost every 2 years, but it's not a guarantee. It also, mm-hmm, it really also depends on what you've got to present and what you've got to show. And I think the programmers there like what I had to offer. Though there is a bit of a story behind that. It was not what we were supposed to offer, perform in reality when we accepted or they offered that to us. So I was a different, yeah, we'll get to that. It was a different program altogether than what was planned.
What was planned?
I was supposed to do my solo, Zeros and Ones, and a duet. Same program I do at the Maison de la Culture, mm-hmm, this year, because I had a tour of the, yep, Maison de la Culture. But my dancer, Giseline Delte, who I danced my duet with, got injured. And she says she just can't do it, and she needs to take some rest and all that. Naturally, it's normal for a dancer. It's happened. They get injured. They just, mm-hmm, can't do it. So what am I going to do? Am I going to remount this duet for just two shows? Or just work on material that I've already been working on throughout the year and just would like to try and, you know, showcase that in front of the public just to see how it goes, to test it. So I decided to bring a piece that I've been working on for about a year that we're not supposed to be presenting till March 2011 at La Gare de Danse, and just experiment with that. Keep, mm-hmm, keep moving forward. Keep experimenting and keep working on new material.
Yes, I noticed on the, which one, on your website, and again, am I allowed to mention the name, or is it,
yes,
still top secret and hush-hush?
No, you're allowed.
There, yeah, Matter of Life and Breath.
Yeah.
There on your website, you have it sort of is with six dancers, and
yes,
last night there were four.
Yeah.
It's sort of working between...
Availability, it's summertime. A lot, yes, of, sometimes dancers are just not around, they're not there. It happened almost, not the last minute, but, you know, I had to pull this together within about 2 months. So, mm-hmm, 2 months ago, I made some phone calls, talked to my dancers. Are you available? Can you do it? And in fact, one of the dancers, Marie-Yves Lafontaine, she was an apprentice for the company. And so I asked her.
She the redhead or the short brunette?
The short brunette, yeah.
I liked her dancing very, very,
yeah,
much.
Yeah, very nice. So she's very, yeah, she just graduated from school. So she jumped in because she knew some of the material. So I had to make some serious adjustments about 2 months ago when I was informed that just then couldn't dance, and had to reorganize my life and my plans in order to make that happen.
So you sort of work with whatever is available at the time in the
exactly.
moment.
Exactly, there it is. Yeah, being really in the moment, work with whatever's available.
Is that also how you end up creating the pieces in terms of sort of figuring out it's okay, let's try this, see if it works, and it's then suddenly ends up as something, or do you have a different method?
A lot of things are influenced by what you're experiencing at the present, at the time, the books maybe that you're reading, stuff that's going on. I was reading the book by Thomas More, Care of the Soul, and there is something in it about Persephone and Hades, because they talk a great deal about he talks a great deal about Greek mythology influencing his work, and that influenced a particular section of the piece. Now, if I wasn't reading that book at that particular time, or we weren't doing the creation at that particular time, that probably wouldn't have had an influence, but it actually did.
Which piece, which part specifically?
The part where the guys, the very, very clear part where the guys were crawling on the ground.
Okay.
And trying to bring the girls down, trying to mm-hmm. weave in between and their legs. And they were Hades.
Okay.
And the girls were Persephone.
And I liked it at the end where you switch the positions.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of different interpretations for that, but my particular influencer or inspiration with that was a Persephone and Hades story, and that was because I was reading that book at that particular time while I was creating.
Okay, and how does that compare to say something like Zeros and Ones with your whole process? Is Zeros and Ones, was it from specific instances, books, reading, things you're reading, or something else as well? The question I'm trying to get to is your process for creating similar for each dance, each choreography, or does it vary widely depending on what you're breathing and what you're eating?
Well, that was a particular, that was very clear of what I wanted with Zeros and Ones. I wanted to do a piece about India and about technology. India was so much in the news these days about it being the growing economy and expanding, and I'm not someone who does a lot of solo work, and when I do something it's because I really want to say something at a particular time, and I'm really exploring a great deal of what is perplexing me and inspiring me at a particular time. At that time I wanted to do a piece about Indian technology. I think a lot of it was because I haven't been back to India for a long, long time, and I went there and I realized how much it had changed in the 10 years I haven't been there. And one of the things that are just mostly that you experience in India is the growing technological advances that are influencing the daily lives of the Indian of people who live in India. Wireless technology, basically. Cell phones. Everyone has a cell phone there. When I went to India for the first time in 1993, my cousins who I visited with, they didn't even have a telephone. They would run to a local shop, or in India you have these places where you just go and you make telephone calls. They would go there, or they'd go to a friend or a neighbor's who had a telephone. Now they have cell phones. Everyone has a cell phone in India, and that's part of the incredible technological shift that has happened there. So I wanted to write create a piece about what I call the e-haves and the e-have-nots, you know, because it's now information and technology is a new currency, and those who have it and those who don't have it. So Zeros and Ones was a great deal about that.
Hi, just to backtrack a little bit for the listeners who don't know you that well, though they should. A lot of your work deals with the clash between East and West.
Yes.
Because that is really the clash inside. Is it a clash inside you because you're half Indian and half Armenian?
Absolutely. Half Indian, half Armenian, born in London, England. I lived there until I was 8 years old, and then I moved to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, 68, from the port of contempt to the harbor of hate. That was part of my rap song that I did. From all those experiences, I keep on telling people I was brought up on fish and chips, not curry, because I don't know much about my Indian background and my Indian culture. It was never taught to me, or I never experienced it, or were never exposed to it. So A lot of my creative impulses and desires to learn about where I come from and the culture that I wasn't exposed to, or that was erased and from me, and a lot of my journey is about that. First of all, learning not the language, because I think, you know, at this particular point, learning Hindi or Punjabi is a bit of a stretch for me. I speak French really, really well, and it took me a long time to learn it. So I'm not someone who acquires languages very, very quickly. But it's just there's no point at this particular time. But what I can learn is I can learn the dance. So I started studying Indian dance. dance in the early 90s to nourish my contemporary dance style, which I have. And that's been part of my vocabulary throughout the last 20 years, the two styles together. But there is, I always do talk about the clash of cultures. And if you were just in the piece Zeros and Ones, the one of the ways I did that was during the film. The Barber of Seville, where I put the Indian expressions, which is called Abhinaya, all the facial expressions, the eye movements, the head movements, and I put that to the music of The Barber of Seville by Rossini. So that's a clash. And that's what I've been experiencing pretty well all my life. Here I am, this Indian guy who knows very little about his culture, and I'm trying to learn about my culture by going to India, by exploring Indian dance, but then I'm putting it in my context of a Western contemporary dance company. So it is all part of what I am experiencing as well.
Indian dance is very complex.
Absolutely.
I saw some tabla. I don't know where in India you're from. I think it's also very regional.
Yeah.
And from the presentation that I saw, actually it came with a woman who explained to the audience what was going on. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that it would be quite an involved process for you to reclaim your heritage and learn all that Indian dance. How do you do that?
By just practice. I'm working with people who are very experienced. I would say not in classical Indian dance, because for me it's important that the person who I work with or who helps me along this journey has a sensibility and an understanding about what I want to do with the vocabulary and where I want to go. So when I started to really decide to take Indian dance seriously, it was at a time when I was working with this dancer whose name is Natasha Bakht, who I've already done three projects with. And she's a classical Indian dancer trained, but she's a contemporary dancer as well. So during that process where we were working together, she would train me and help me understand what it was that I was looking for and what I needed to explore my expression of that vocabulary. And it wasn't pure. It wasn't a pure classical sense of it. Both of us, Natasha and I, when we create our works, were interested in how we can bend the vocabulary a bit, or a lot. But still try and retain a sense of the vigor of and the discipline and the complexity of the work. So it was collaborating with people with same mindsets.
That's right, because if you had a dance guru who was very strict about how things have to be, that would be an impediment to your creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't find that inspiring. When I first started studying Indian dance, it was a lot of it wasn't what I was interested in, and it was also hard to find a good teacher. And Natasha Bakht, she doesn't consider herself a guru or a teacher. She's a contemporary dancer and choreographer like myself. But in our process, in our creative process, it was learning through the creative process as opposed to someone teaching me, you got to do this, you got to do that, you can go to do this. It was the process that helped me. So I don't consider myself trained in Indian dance, not at all. And I do not consider myself a Bharatanatyam dancer or trained in Bharatanatyam dancer, just as I don't consider myself a ballet dancer, even though I take ballet class and I can do all that stuff. I can do five turns and leap and jump and do quite well. I don't consider myself a ballet dancer, just as I don't consider myself an Indian dancer. But I think what I've learned, I've learned well, and I'm able to exploit it to satisfy what I want to portray to the public.
My question is getting back to that whole cultural thing. First of all, the easy question, how and why Saskatoon?
That's where I moved to when I left England.
That I understand.
Yeah.
Was it that your folks got a job there that
Absolutely.
You decided that, yeah. Which month, it was the place to be?
No. I was 8 years old at the time. Yes. I had no decision whatsoever. Good. So this is, that was part of my journey, going from London, England, at 8 years of age to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, because my dad got a job.
Because that was one thing that struck me in terms of one of the other pieces that you did was Haters and Baiters.
Yeah.
And because I'm originally from New York, and we moved here when I was 12.
Uh-huh.
And in that first year of grade six, I just got the crap beaten out of me every other day.
Same as me, grade eight.
Yes.
Got the crap beat out of me every single day
for
weeks.
Then I was realizing that... Yeah, there was a sort of parallel thing, although obviously the reasons and rationales for us getting beat up when we were children were completely different. Or whatchamacallit, I was just the new kid, the snot-nosed, uppity New Yorker who talked too much. And so, yes, everybody wanted to put me in my place.
Well, I was this brown kid who just came from England, so I talked a lot like this, and so I just didn't fit in. And we're talking about Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, 1968. Not a lot of kids of color in the province, let alone the city of Saskatoon. I was one of the only kids of color in my school. And, yeah, I got the crap beat out of me for weeks and weeks on end. And as a response to that, I did not want to tell people where I came from. I did not want to tell people that I was an Indian, because then I would be afraid that they'd think I was a Paki, which is a derogatory word for Indian. It was like, you know, it's not something I wanted to reveal, because I was just afraid of getting beat up again. So for many, many years, I grew up with the shame of being Indian. I would just tell people I was from Armenia. So I get this puzzled look on people's faces. Because where's that? Oh, it's somewhere in the Middle East somewhere. So, it's, you know, the more vague I gave as a question, the less, because, you know, why would they beat me up for being Armenian? They didn't even know where that was, you know.
Which leads to the second question I have in terms of, you obviously now do identify much stronger with the Indian culture.
Yes.
Was there a conscious decision to sort of not identify with Armenian
culture?
No,
not a conscious decision. I think it was just a decision through my art, because of the dance form, and because, you know, when it has become such an issue to you, it takes on so much weight in terms of your life that you just decide, you make that as a choice. Because I had to confront the fact that I was ashamed to say where I came from. I had to deal with that. As an artist, you have a responsibility, or you should try and get to know as much as you possibly can about yourself and where you're from and where you're going and who you are. All these questions arise that may not necessarily arise when you want to reveal yourself, because in your art you are in a sense trying to reveal parts of yourself. So I had to respond to my question, why was I so ashamed for many, many years to tell people where I came from? And this one of my first pieces, Burning Skin, I think that was the piece that launched me, I guess, on my creative choreographic career, because it was quite successful. It was filmed for the CBC, and it toured India, it toured England, across Canada. It did very, very well. And it was about that question. And the piece Burning Skin was inspired by the writings of Anif Qureshi, who's a very well-known writer from England. And in his biography, he wrote, from the very start, I tried to deny my Pakistani self. I was ashamed. It was a curse, and I wanted to be rid of it. I wanted to be just like everybody else. And that's my story. So reading that inspired me, and I think it's also inspired me, this brown guy is a successful artist, and if he can do this by revealing parts of himself that are difficult to reveal, well, I can do the same thing as well. So identifying with someone who has gone through your journey was a great deal of help for me in order to find my path and my journey, because he was an artist and I'm an artist. And it all happened around that, you know, that time when I was first starting to become a creator.
I just was sort of thinking last night and watching in terms of the Indian influences are sort of evident, and then realizing, oh yeah, Armenian, there is Armenian dance as well, and there's that whole thing, and then just trying to figure out, okay, I was sort of doing these sort of thought experiments of, okay, so how would that change if it had been Armenian influenced, and I couldn't figure it out for the life of me.
The classical Indian dance is a vigorous tradition, a vigorous art form. I would compare it to ballet. You have to start when you're very, very young, and it's very impressive. The art dance form, Armenian, is a folk art form. And not denigrating in any way whatsoever. It just didn't inspire me. It just doesn't inspire me. It's beautiful. It's like, but
Now, one of the interesting sort of cross-cultural things is previously we had a Korean dancer on here, and it was the week after the Croatian national folk dance troupe came to Place des Arts.
Yeah.
And I saw a Korean-inspired breakdance.
Wow.
And the Croatian national folk dance troupe do a traditional dance that was 500 years old. They're pretty much both the same exact thing.
What? No. Seriously?
It was basically some sort of handmade drum bang, 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 with very slow, deliberate movements. And, yeah, because it was breakdance influenced, but it was still slow. It was the sort of thing where it wasn't all the twisting and floor work and so on that you'd not normally get with breakdance. Oh, yeah. And then because the Croatian stuff was extremely formal, it was just that same slow pace. And obviously, I would imagine because I'm not trained in any sort of dance notation system or anything like that, there, like, if you look at them side by side, you can probably see differences within the actual individual movements. But just at a first sort of gut impression, I'm saying, wow, that's pretty damn cool.
Well, Indian dance, speed and precision and detail. And that's kind of the way I normally would move anyways. I move fast, and even without the Indian dance influence, there's always a lot of hand gestures in my moving. And in fact, that was one of the ways reasons why I also wanted to go towards this particular dance form, Bharatanatyam, which is from the south of India, because of the mudras, the gestures. Because even before I started studying Indian dance, my style was moving a great deal using my hands and my fingers, without knowing that is almost very Indian itself. I guess it was in my genes. It was in there somewhere.
Actually, how did you come to dance?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, after I left high school and went to Toronto, I went to University of Toronto to study economics.
Oh, very different.
Very different. You know, you're young. You want to take a you want to get educated, something that'll get you a job or whatever. And I didn't understand a damn thing. Not throughout the whole 3 years I was in there. Surpluses and deficits and deficits and surpluses. I mean, what does all this mean? It just didn't make much sense to me. And so I wasn't very happy in that whole university experience. And when I'm unhappy, I have a tendency to eat quite a lot. And you know, when you're in residency at U of T, you drink a lot of beer, and you just I put on like 30 pounds.
Wow.
But finally, after 3 years of university, I understood economics, because my happiness was in deficit and my weight was in surplus.
Not a good combination.
I guess it was to get in shape, back in shape. And I started taking dance classes because I said, hey, this is a way that I might be able to get back in shape. Now, I had done karate for many, many years, and I tried it out, and I found it didn't interest me that much anymore. Mm-hmm. And so when I started doing dance classes, it was like a good food right away. And I knew within weeks, and this is what I wanted to do.
What kind of dance was it?
It was jazz.
Jazz dance.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the movies that was happening at that particular time was a movie such as The Chorus Line and All That Jazz, the movie about Bob Fosse. And man, I love that movie. It was brilliant and very, very inspiring. And I just said to myself also, I mean, beside the fact that I also wanted to lose weight and all that, I says, I've got to do this. I love what they're doing. And then, so I was doing jazz for many, many weeks. And one time, in the jazz studio, because they also have ballet classes happening at the same time, I saw this ballet dancer who was from the touring company of Evita. Now, normally in the ballet classes, you don't get a sense of a level of professionalism from day to day of the people that are there, but these guys took class in the same studio that I was learning jazz. So I just peeked in, and I saw this one male dancer, and I wish I knew his name so I could refer it to him, and he blew me away. He was so inspiring. I just said, I have to do this.
That's amazing.
And so I dropped all my jazz completely. That was it. Ballet. Seriously, for 2 years.
Hardcore.
Yeah. But you know, I started dance at 84. I was like 24, 25 years old, and having a ballet, starting ballet at that age, it was not very, very realistic. It's been done.
Yeah, I mean, it's been done, and you're doing it. And is that also how you got into choreography then?
No, I mean, I got into modern dance, contemporary dance, because I realized that you know, ballet is a very vigorous, sometimes almost a cruel world in terms of what their expectations of the shape of the body and the age and the look and everything like that. It just wasn't my place. So I started doing modern dance and contemporary dance. Mm-hmm. So I dropped ballet. As a guy, I dropped all my ballet classes and started doing modern dance. I went to a modern dance school called the School of the Toronto Dance Theatre, a very well-known school in Canada as an institution. And there we are. I started doing contemporary dance, and that's here I am after that. Choreography is because I've always wanted to create. There's a creative instinct in me, and that's really where I was at that.
How did you get to Montreal?
Well, I was living in Quebec. I got my first gig in Quebec City. I didn't even finish my school at Toronto Dance Theatre. It was after 2 years, I realized I wanted to work. I wanted to get a job. I had talent. I was good. I was, for someone who started at a late age, I had a lot of ability when I was younger. So after 2 years, I had this offer to go dance for this company in Quebec City called Danse Partout, which no longer exists right now. And I went there. And I went there for 2 years. And when I was working with Danse Partout in Quebec, I saw that there was a lot of activity in Montreal. I mean, we all know that Montreal has a reputation for being somewhat of a dance mecca. And certainly back at that time, the early 90s, late 80s, it was legend. And I just said to myself, okay, well, Quebec City is a very nice city, but you know, I'm more of someone who needs to be in a place a bit more cosmopolitan, that moves a bit more, and has more of a dance scene. There was no dance scene in Quebec City. There was just Danse Partout. That was it, and a few other small independent dance. So I moved here. I had a girlfriend at that time who moved to Montreal before me, and I went and I joined her, and here I am. And I first started working for a number of choreographers: Jean-Pierre Perrault, Sylvain Aymar. In fact, I arrived in Montreal, and when you arrive as a dancer in Montreal, the first thing you do is you do a dance class. So I do a dance class at the Foundation Jean-Pierre Perrault, and Jean-Pierre was there, and he saw me afterwards, and he knew me because he had created already a piece for Danse Partout. So we knew each other. So he knew me as a dancer. And after that first class, and this is a question of timing as well, he just lost a dancer the day before. I think it was because a dancer had to get an operation or something like that, was injured. And so there I was. That day, he knew me, he saw me at dance class, and he came up right after dance class and asked me, Roger, would you like to go to New York with me and 24 other dancers for a project I'm doing in New York?
Oh, gee, let me think.
the same day I arrived.
Amazing.
And who were the dancers in his company at that time? Sylvain Aymard, Pierre-Paul Savoie, Ellen Blackburn, Tom Stroud, most of these people who I eventually ended up working with. So in my first gig with Jean-Pierre Perrault, I got to know half the dance community here in Montreal. And that's how it happens. You got to know people. Mm. It's really important to get inside the circle. And that's what helped me get inside the circle.
How do you see Montreal's dance community now in comparison to back then in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, it was really explosive with the back in the late 80s, early 90s, with the Festival International, the Nouvelle Monde was very, really highly reputed, and companies like La 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 Human Step, So Vertigo were just, you know, they were off the map. Yes. In terms of the kind of activities and the reputation they were having. I think Montreal's a little less now of the mecca that it used to be, but it's still a place, a very creative place, where people are doing very, very interesting stuff. And I think now the shift now has happened towards works that do reflect different cultures. Back then it was so Quebecois, so Quebecois, mm-hmm. So white. You know, you would just see, you wouldn't see the diversity now that you see. So you have now companies like myself. You have companies.
Emmanuel Jutz,
Ismael Meraki. Zab Bagumbu's mm-hmm. been around for a long mm-hmm. time, but she's getting now, you know, finally the recognition that she deserves. So there's a lot more diversity happening, and right now, Montreal's still alive and still doing. I mean, look at the FTA, the Festival Théâtre des Amériques. Mm-hmm. It's the interest is really, really mm-hmm. there.
It's the sort of thing where, from my perspective, and this is just as an outside observer, it was the sort of thing that back in the 80s, there was like things which were must-sees. It's you had to go see them.
Yeah.
Now, 20, 25 years later, I'm just absolutely fascinated by just how many different dance companies there are, because there's, I don't know, probably about 10 times as many dancers, dance companies, performances that happen now than there were then.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that just sort of gets me, I don't know, that I find interesting is probably the polite way to say it, is that where I find in Montreal, and I don't know if this happens elsewhere, is that there is room to fail. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of thing where, such as your performance last night of A Matter of Life and Breath, where it's a work in progress.
Yes.
And so it's a sort of thing where I very much have now gotten into the habit of knowing to go see a world premiere, somebody's first show and so on, with extremely low expectations, because I know that it's going to tour for 3 years, it's going to come back, it's going to be reworked, it's going to be solid, and then the final performance is the one, to me, that is the actual real performance, because everything else is a work in progress, and it's trying to work out what works best, how, why, and so on. And I'm not certain if there's any other place in the world where it is possible to do something like that.
Well,
in a public performance.
In Europe, there's that kind of space to do that. Europe really endorses process is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're allowed to try things out, mm-hmm. and not necessarily focus too much on the final during the process. For me, it's just because I'm getting a lot of opportunities to perform that particular work in various mm-hmm. venues. It's the second time, actually, the work has been performed on stage within the last year. I performed it at Festival Transatlantic, not Transameric, mm-hmm. Festival Transatlantic that Rafik Sabah organizes. And I did a version of that as well. And it allows me to test my ideas in mm-hmm. front of a public. And we get that here in Quebec, because the support for the artists in Quebec is so much more available than from other provinces. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We get the luxury to do that. Now I get the luxury to hire dancers for weeks at a time to be able to just try something like this out on stage, because that piece wasn't supposed to be presented last mm-hmm. night. No, it was supposed to be my duet Thread, and I couldn't present it because the dancer was injured. So I decided to present that work instead, because I had mm-hmm. the budget for it. Yeah. I mean, I says, okay, well, you know, let me try this.
Now, to me, it's a completely different landscape between then and now,
yeah.
and it's then just trying to just sort of come to terms with the landscape and realize, okay, this is, and it's a sort of thing of, it's a nurturing landscape as opposed to a sort of, what would it be?
A very critical.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly.
I think Montrealers have seen so much dance that they are open to new ideas. And they sit in their seats and they say, okay, surprise me. And you don't see that a lot.
Yeah, I'm going to have to surprise you now.
Okay.
We have to take a break. We have a couple of ads. We have some other sort of silly stuff and so on. But yes, this is Movement Museum, where we talk about dance in Montreal on your radio, on your computer, on your mobile devices, all over the place. It's 2:40. And then, yeah, where you can find us is 90.3 FM on your radio, 91.7 on your cable dial, and movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computers and mobile devices. We will be back momentarily. And we're back. At some point, I'm going to have to figure out something else to say besides, and we're back.
It's very apt.
My name is Zeke. I'm here with Bettina. We're talking with Roger Sinha about dance in Montreal. But before we get back to that, we should come up with a theme if we're going to do today in dance history.
Yes, I think we're going to have to record another promo or something for this. So we always like to give a little perspective. And today we are going to talk about Paul Taylor, who was born on July 29th, which is today. And he is one of the foremost American choreographers of the 20th century. He was born in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, and attended Syracuse University, where he first took up dance. He continued his studies at the Juilliard School and the American Dance Festival at Connecticut College. In 1952, his dancing at the American Dance Festival attracted the attention of choreographers Martha Graham, José Limón, Charles Whiteman, and Doris Humphrey. He performed in the companies of Merce Cunningham, Martha Graham, and George Balanchine, and founded the Paul Taylor Dance Company in 1954. Dancers who emerged from his company include Tyler Thorpe, Laura Dean, Dan Wagoner, Carolyn Adams, Christopher Gills, Santa Driver, and David Parsons. The use of everyday gestures rather than dance moves is characteristic of his choreography. He has collaborated with painters Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Jones, and Alec Katz, as well as the legendary Tiffany Company's designer Jean Moore. A signature work is Esplanade, which he did in 1975, to music by Johann Sebastian Bach, which he choreographed with a contribution from the National Endowments for the Arts. In 1993, he was awarded the National Medal of Arts. And that was Paul Taylor, who was born today.
80 years ago.
Rather.
Yeah, he's an old guy.
Yeah, nicely done, though.
And then I just want one brief thing, and that is 12 years ago, Jerome Robbins died. He's the guy who was responsible for West Side Story, On the Town, Gypsy, Fiddler on the Roof, and a whole whack of other things. It's Wikipedia is very helpful for finding these things out. But yes, we're back with Roger. Roger Sinha from Sinha Dance. And in the background, you can hear Damien and Marika, because the microphones are all over the place. This is the radio.
It's one of my favorite sounds is hearing kids giggle. We should have kids every day.
I keep trying to get them on the microphone, but they keep saying no, no, no.
They pretend they can't hear you.
That's because they don't have the headphones on.
That's it.
Roger, you're speaking about how Bob Fosse was sort of the way that you're sort of seeing the light in dance and stuff like that. As far as other specific choreographers, dancers, the unnamed one who was in that ballet class, are there any other people you can give shout-outs to?
Louis Le Cavalier remains still my idol in terms of dancers. I love to work with a lot of the human steps, and Edward Locke has been one of the choreographers who have inspired me. The humor of Jeanette Lorrain in her works and the humanity of her works as well inspire me quite a bit. At that time, back then, when I was getting involved in dance. Now, you know, I found my own vocabulary, my own voice, and these days, companies such as Ballet C de la B, I find inspiring to me. Numerous choreographers. Okay.
And is there anybody coming up on the scene? Because that's also one of the things that I'm sort of noticing is a generational shift in terms of, yes, it's at the FTA. You have, Louise Le Cavalier redoing stuff that she did from 15, 20 years ago. There are, then at the same time, there are people like Fred Gravel who are coming up and seem to be new. Is any of the new generation, any dancers in your company that you have high hopes for?
Gislaine Doté, who danced in the piece Thread, is doing some work now that's very, very interesting. Up and coming, but there are so many to think of. Gibson Mareva is doing some interesting work. There are many.
Okay. Then on a slightly different thing, it's also I noticed that within your dance there is a lot of, as you said, karate, sort of keeping in contemporary times, because when I follow on the radio, mixed martial arts, which is just a bizarre way of doing things, but I'm a very big radio fan, as you might imagine. And I'm trying to work out in terms of how much, because dance itself to me seems to be everything is combining. It's sort of imploding on itself, and uh-huh. There's no longer the contemporary dance, ballet, jazz, breakdance. Everybody seems to be doing a little bit of everything combining together. And this next generation, to my mind, will come out with something that is just absolutely bizarre. It is that sort of martial arts sort of thing, which I'm wrestling with, trying to figure out, okay, so can it be considered dance? Is it considered dance?
Well, it depends on how you... I mean, I involve... I use martial arts a great deal as my influence in my work, but in a very different way. I use it the way the muscles are being used, as opposed to on a literal interpretation, a literal representation of the work with a kick and a punch. I just don't do that. But I do use the way the muscles are used, the energy, the relationships between two people when they dance together, this kind of... not that it's a fight or a battle, but there's this kind of use of the body that comes from sparring, which I call sparring, the fighting and the battling that goes on in the martial arts.
Yeah, no, I noticed a bit of it in the Matter of Life and Breath, that whole sort of that beginning part where the women were sort of chopping at the guys who were hanging out on the cross.
That's actually a very formal dance position. It's called a Natyarambi, and that they're standing there. If you know anyone who knows Indian dance, would not see that as being as a representation of classical Indian dance. So with the way they're standing,
Well, although there was women chopping at them, that I sort of said was okay. This is the fight scene. The women are beating up on the guys.
Always open to interpretation, isn't it?
Yeah, and it helps also that I don't have the vocabulary, so I can just make up my own.
So you just appreciate the formal beauty of it, and then you just interpret it anyway.
You got it.
That fits within the neurons in your head. And to what I wrote about martial arts, I think it's not maybe exactly dance, but it certainly is movement, and very precise movement. Mm-hmm. And it has to be precise, because if your movement is off, you're not hitting your opponent.
Yeah.
I took years and years of Tai Chi, and the way my teacher would correct me is that she would suddenly take a bamboo stick and just attack me. and you know, immediately your hands go to the right position. She says, you see, that is grasping sparrow tail. So I say, okay, I get it now. So integrating it into contemporary dance makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Did you see the piece this year with all those Buddhist, those monks?
Yes. I did not like it at all.
Oh, no, I can't. I didn't see it.
Okay, I found it so completely colonial in its sort of way of being presented that I was unable to sort of remove myself from it, so as to get into the sort of idea of the performance and so on. And it just, because it was... the Belgian guy whose name escapes me now, but
he
was playing Puppet Master.
Yeah.
And that just, my head almost exploded. I got so angry and did not like that at all.
Okay.
But
that's nice to hear. It's nice to hear. I mean, a different perspective. A lot of people.
City Larbi Sharkwi.
City, that's it, yeah.
Although I'm probably mispronouncing his name.
Yeah. Well, I've liked his works in the past. He's from the Balisid Lubi tradition.
Yes.
And he's presented some foie. I remember one of the first pieces I saw of his. I was quite impressed.
Now, it's less said about it, the better.
Okay.
So what has been the response to your dance in India? Is the feedback very different from what you get here?
Now, I did a tour in India a year ago in February, and yes, the response is quite different. Depends on also where you go. When I went to New Delhi, they had a bit more knowledge about contemporary dance. But when I would go to places like Ahmedabad, where they rarely see, or at least rarely see Western contemporary dance, because I was coming as a Western contemporary dancer. And a lot of the times they're looking for the story in the dance, because a lot of their dance forms that they do is representational. It's based on the Mahabharata or other books that have been written. So a lot of the times, for example, I do a very in my tour, I had a piece called Cobasian Rhapsody. And it was a piece I do with a dancer, a female dancer. So they're looking for the love, the love story in it, where it's not. It's really about two energies together. Like the piece Life and Breath last night. I mean, there are men and women dancing together, mm-hmm. but it's just not necessarily about, you know, romance or something like that. So it was for much of the public, it was difficult for them to understand. So there was a lot of questions about that. Is this person Hanuman or is this person Rama? And I see. So it was difficult.
Yeah, they were trained to look for a narrative.
That's exactly what.
Rather than a concept.
Yeah, narrative is what they're looking for. Now, I presented Burning Skin there, which is a poetic piece, but it was a lot easier to grasp. It's clearly about racism. Mm. The subject matter is very, very clear. So they really, really appreciated that and understand that. There's text in it. And a lot of for a piece like stuff like Zeros and Ones, a lot of it just, some of it went really, really over the people's heads. Because one thing, the text in it's very, very, it's a very poetic, in-your-face kind of rappish kind of text. And even though many, many people there speak many people, English is very, very, very well spoken in India, the way I said it, the vernacular I had, hard for a lot of the public to grasp. That's why I did the subtitles last night.
All right.
In my piece.
One of the things that occurred to me is that for the Francophone audience, they're experiencing it completely differently.
Yeah.
Because the narrative that you speak or your speech is not a linear one. And
no.
There are definitely different things coming in.
Yeah.
However, you put the text up on the wall and it is left to right, top to bottom.
Yeah.
And it is just a continuous thread, which to me is a different way of understanding it entirely.
Yeah, I tried it in French in my tour, the Maison de la Culture, mm-hmm. and even though I speak French very, very well, a lot of people comments were that they just really couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. It's poetry.
Yes.
I mean, even in English, it's a hard thread to follow, mm-hmm. but you do get a sense of it, a grasp of it. You know, when you say something, that idiot son's got a job, now it's done. Offshoring, outsourcing, the blind tiger returns, the young widow burns. So, you know, you get a sense of it, whereas when I tried it in French, it didn't have the same impact.
No, they're my suggestion. If you're open to suggestions, would be to keep the wall text in terms of the subtitles.
Yeah.
But then do it where it is, as opposed to just a straight line that is a straight translation of what you're reading.
Uh-huh.
Do it in the sort of thing where words come out and there are multiple repetitions of the words, so that the text itself, sort of like concrete poetry, where the text itself almost starts to look like what you're saying.
Yeah.
And that, with a simple PowerPoint presentation, probably could do something like that. You knock it together. But that would be if you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And feel free to ignore it as well. Lots of people ignore my ideas all the time.
Going back to the India tour, it was quite an experience. I actually, if you want to visit my Indian tour, I have a vlog, video log of what I did. And if you would go to my, you will find a trace of that if you go to my my website, cinedance.com. Every couple of days, I would film our experience. I'd edit it and put it on Vimeo,
I'm still working on Burning Skin. And once I've got that, then it's okay, let's go through that one by one by one.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea to do a video log for for all your followers, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's I'm more of a visual person. I don't write much. I never have a notebook. I always start a journal and then I leave it and I forget about it for years after that. And just say, I got to do my journal again. I'm visual. I like working I like video and I like working that way. So
it's a perfect medium for somebody who needs to capture movement.
Yeah, absolutely. So you could see a trace of my voyage in India last year, and it was not easy. It was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The theaters were fantastic and able to support the technical requirements of the work. But the others were like, oof, very, very difficult.
Bit of an adventure.
Yeah, it was an adventure. It really was. Yeah.
Do you still have family there?
Yeah, I have still many cousins and nephews, and none of them came to see my show, unfortunately.
Oh.
It's too bad. Different priorities and different things came up. But I still lost family there. When I went there for the first time in 1993, I spent a month just visiting family.
Fantastic.
And it was the first time I met them. It was the first time I met my Indian family. And for them, it was like their their uncle or their brother coming home, because my dad, when he left India in the early 50s, he never looked back. He never went back to India, so they've never seen him after that.
Wow.
So I was visiting my uncles, who I've never seen before, who look so much like my dad, yet are so different from him. Huh. So that was a different experience.
Did they inspire some of your work afterwards?
My first trip to India did inspire me to create a work which I call Pehla Safar, and I'm really pronouncing that really badly. It's Hindi for first journey. Mm-hmm. I created a work after that.
Okay, and then also, it's you'd mentioned just before we come on air, this is completely divorced from everything else, but that you're about to celebrate the 20th anniversary of your company.
Yes, in 2011, it'll be 20 years that the company's been around. And I hope to celebrate that with the final version of my show, Life and Breath, at La Gorge La Danse in March, the full-length version of it with six dancers.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, we had Francine Bernier in here in studio.
Oh, yeah.
And we're very much looking forward to seeing it.
Great.
Mm-hmm. No, there then, speaking of 20 years, it then naturally leads into another thing of just aging as a dancer.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine that, yes, you're for thread where you're, the person you're supposed to dance with has an injury. Uh-huh. But I imagine after last night, you woke up with a couple of, like, aches and soreness.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Your joints get drier. It becomes a lot more painful. That's why I'm going to be slowly taking myself off the stage and leave all that for a younger dancer. Mm-hmm. I'm doing Zeros and Ones in Toronto in November for a series called Old and Reckless.
Okay.
It's for dancers who are over 40. So now since I'm over 50, I'm more than eligible to participate.
Now, it's one of the things you talk about, the difference, or coming back to that difference between dance then and dance now. It's realizing that, there was this film that I am endlessly fascinated with, Carmen and Jeffrey, which is about Carmen Lavallade and Jeffrey Holder. Uh-huh. And she is dancing now, and she's like 80. Uh-huh. And how, back when I was Marika and Damien's age, it was the sort of thing where you had to be under the age of 30. Yeah. You had to be skinny as a stick, and that was the only way you could be a dancer. And now it's like everybody and anything can dance.
Yeah, I mean, look at me. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not exactly skinny as a stick. I'm fairly robust and fairly large as a dancer. I don't want to, I don't want to hide my age. I'm 50 years old, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of what I've done and how I've gotten here. And I'm a better dancer actually now than I was 10, 20 years ago, because I'm more interested in more mature dancers. I mean, for the kind of work that I have to do, late 30s, early 40s, mm-hmm. is the best. I find the best period, because often you get your dancers to not create the work, but you ask them to generate material and to provide creative nourishment for you. So the older you are, and the more experiences you have in the world, and the more experiences you've had in this business, the more you can get out of them. So even like in that piece last night, Life and Breath, I have Tanya and Tom, who've been around for a good 15 to 20 years as dancers. And then I have Laurence Ramsey and Marie-Ève Le Fontaine, who are just starting. They just graduated from school like last year. So there's quite a difference of ages and experiences. And for myself, like I said, I'm a better dancer now than I was years ago, but I have to tailor the kind of dance that I do now. I can't do what my dancers do in Life and Breath. I just can't. It's just too hard. It's just too physically demanding. It requires stamina and energy that you just don't have. But physically, those are the kind of works that I like to create with group dancers. Mm-hmm. But when I'm doing it as a solo artist, I do text, I do rap, I do... Most of the stuff I do in Zeros and Ones is actually improvisation, because I'm working with interactive technology, and I'm more interested in working that way and presenting my work as a solo artist in that manner, as an individual, doing mixed media work, using text, theater, film. I'm doing a lot more film now. The piece Haters and Baiters, which was presented, was one of my second dance film that I created. And it won the Public Choice Award for the Radio Canada International Short Film Award.
Cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, congratulations.
I have a lot more questions, but we're out of space.
Okay.
Primetime just showed up. Positive vibes. It's just after 3 o'clock. My name is Zeke. I've been here with Bettina, talking about dance in Montreal, specifically with Roger Sinha of Sinha Dance. Thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thank you, Zeke and Bettina.
Wonderful having you. Bettina, thank you again for making me look better and sound better than I have any right to be. And yeah, we'll be back next week on CKUT 90.3 FM on your radio dial, 91.7 on your cable dial, and movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer and your mobile devices.
All I wanna do is dance.